You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us today here at the Carnegie Endowment on this event on oil prices and Middle East turmoil, the economic consequences. As is customary with us these days, this will be more of a conversation. And the conversation is with this distinguished panel. You have their curricula, so I'm just going to quickly introduce them. At the extreme right, no intention of anticipating his views, is Christopher Buczek, who is associate in the Carnegie Middle East program and a specialist on particularly on Yemen, but also more broadly on the Gulf countries. And to his immediate left is Hans Timmer, who is director of the Development Prospects Group at the World Bank. That is the group that analyzes the global economy and the developing countries at the World Bank. And then to his left is Jamie Webster, who is a senior manager for markets and country strategies at PFC Energy. And Jamie's specialty is, of course, the oil market globally, but with a particular focus on the Middle East. And then to my immediate right is Mohsin Khan, who I'm sure is known to many of you. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and until fairly recently was the head of the Middle East and Central Asia Department at the International Monetary Fund. So together, these gentlemen cover the various aspects of this issue, the macro, the oil market, and the political turmoil that is at the source of today's concerns in the oil markets. I will have a structured set of questions, and we will then open it up to questions and answers. I'm going to try and structure the questions around, first of all, the Middle East turmoil and its impact on oil markets. The second set of questions will be very specifically on the oil markets, the supply and demand balance, and so on and so forth scenarios. And the third set of questions will be on the economic consequences, the macroeconomic consequences. And I'm going to encourage our panelists really to address these issues, across the board, meaning I'm not going to try and focus every question to the expert, but rather encourage them to participate. And then we will open it up for questions and answers. The structured part of questions that I will lead probably take about an hour or so. That leaves us about half an hour for questions and answers later. So let me start then with the chapter on the Middle East turmoil. And I'd like to perhaps ask Jamie and Mohsin to address the following questions, which is, what have been the effects of the turmoil so far on oil prices, and why have they evolved in the way that they have? So either Mohsin or Jamie, maybe Jamie, you want to start it off?
Obviously, the first thing that has happened and is makes kind of sense, at least from my standpoint, is the oil price has risen. It's around $115 right now for Brent, around $405 for WTI. This was primarily as we started to roll through this issue. You saw originally The first issue was in Tunisia, which essentially had no effect on the market whatsoever. Tunisia is not a major oil exporter, not a major demand country. It was essentially just not an issue for the Middle East. Then it started to move to Egypt. And Egypt, while it is not a major oil exporter, is a major place for transit, and it became a transit risk. And so you saw a bit of a price, the price begin to jump up a little bit, both from a risk premium, but also some concerns that you wouldn't be able to move the oil through the Suez or move oil through the SUMED pipeline. While that didn't occur, and it didn't occur for a couple of reasons, one, I think as Mubarak was kind of pushed out, he was essentially only the head that was pushed out and not the full structure of the state. And so no one had any real interest to impact future oil revenues going forward. You did see that a number of tankers and like did not use the Suez throughway there during that time, which was fine. It adds around 10 to 12 days of extra travel. But the world is in a position where we've got enough supply that it could handle that. Then it moved over to Libya, which became a production risk, and then it actually became a real production disruption. And then once you move to a production disruption, the concerns began to be, well, where is this oil going to come from? And then not just where is the oil going to come from, is this oil, which is what was termed a light sweet oil, a very nice oil that makes a lot of great gasoline, as we all like to drive with, how is that going to be replaced? Most of the Saudi Arabia spare capacity is actually a sour oil, not heavy sour. So there was a concern that as it moved over towards, that this could potentially move towards Saudi Arabia. And the concerns with Saudi Arabia is if something would happen there, even if it was a slight thing, markets would take that as a real indication that not only is there a production risk, but there's a spare capacity risk that we don't have that ability. And so many markets are still very much focused to determine if something is going to happen with Saudi Arabia. So you've seen the price go up. In reality, from our standpoint, of course, every analyst got his own views, the price right now without all of these issues should be around $80 or $90. But because there is a real risk in the economy that that something else could go off, Algeria or the like, and would then have to be replaced by Saudi Arabia, there's still that potential for some real growth. And so while we can handle these higher prices from a supply-demand balance, our concerns start to shift more towards what it will do to the economy. Going forward, even if things start to calm down with Libya and everybody stops protesting and the like, the Libyan barrels are going to stay off the market for a long period of time. So those are not going to return. The concerns and the questions about Saudi Arabia's ability to meet both its current production and actually raise production if needed to its spare capacity levels of 12.5 million barrels is going to be continued to look at. And so without some sort of serious demand response, I don't see the oil price dropping down below, you know, $100 again. I also don't see it rising up.
Let me. I will come back.
I'm a consultant. I can talk all day.
I know. I will come back to the future, so to speak. Let me ask Mohsin if you have anything to add.
No, I agree with the facts as laid out. I think one of the things to remember is that in December, well before any of this trouble started, oil prices had already hit 90. And so I think that Egypt with the Suez fear, Libya with the fear of disruption also started to push up prices. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the fear really was that will the disruption spread to Saudi Arabia? Because that is the giant in the picture. And so I think if you put it in perspective, yes, Libyan oil has been lost, but I mean, Libyan oil and Libya supplies roughly 1.5 million barrels a day. Even if that's wiped off completely right now, we're talking about a market that's about between 88 million to 90 million barrels a day supply. So it's not that big a deal. Yet the price moved very quickly. So even a marginal change caused the price to move. And so I think it was less a supply, actual supply disruption, and more a fear of future supply disruptions, and particularly in the Gulf. When the troubles start in Bahrain, now Bahrain is not an oil exporter, so it doesn't matter, but I mean the worry was that it would spread to Saudi Arabia, it would spread to maybe to Kuwait, maybe to the giants in the area. So I think, you know, I'll stay away from looking forward, but I take the view that you know, we are now in a situation where there is still fear and oil prices are going to continue to be volatile. They've been fairly steady at 115, that's Brent, for the last few days. But any shock, and I think I don't see any positive shocks right now, any negative shock that comes along will push prices up further. I mean, the IMF says that if oil prices are at 120 and sustained, that could be damaging for the world economy. We're almost at 120. And I think that what it's going to be like for the course of this year and beyond is, to some extent, anybody's guess. But I have a guess, too, and I can come back to that.
Good. Chris, so everybody's pointing the finger here and saying it all depends on what happens in Saudi Arabia. And I'd like you to give us your best assessment of what is the likelihood that this turmoil would spread. Now, they've pointed the finger at Saudi Arabia, but really, you know, I mean, there are a lot of other important producers in that part of the world. Iran is an important exporter. Iraq is an important exporter. And several of the Gulf countries, Kuwait, Mohsin has mentioned Kuwait, several of the Gulf countries are very, very important exporters. What is the likelihood that the turmoil will spread? What do you think?
Well, I think the last 2 months has probably taught people not to make too many predictions about what will or will not happen in the Middle East. And I guess that said, picking up on these points about Saudi Arabia, it strikes me that of all the countries in the region, Saudi Arabia is the best equipped to manage this current crisis in terms of the resources at the government's disposal. And if we look at what the Saudi government has done, it's pretty remarkable. $130 billion in new spending that's been announced, financed entirely through current foreign reserve holdings. The Saudis have deployed the religious establishment to send the message that protests are not authorized and that this kind of behavior is not tolerated. You know, basically, Saudi Arabia manages difficult times through a combination of three things. It's either force or religious ideology or money. And we see that the Saudis have deployed all three very effectively. So the Day of Rage that was called for earlier this month really kind of fizzled out. There were some protests in the eastern province and some arrests with the Shia community. There were some small protests that took place inside the capital in Riyadh, but this did not materialize like people were thinking. So I think while there's still a fear that this could happen in Saudi Arabia, I think the Saudis, of all the countries in the region, are doing, you know, the best to try to manage this as best they can. You know, that said, how this current crisis, you know, the unrest and the protests will sort of coalesce with other challenges in Saudi Arabia, like the pending leadership transition. At some point, the current king will die and there will need to be a shift from the generation of the sons of Abdulaziz to the next generation. So how the country manages that with everything else going on is something to watch. The other point that I would make is how long the Saudis can continue to keep up this spending, and how that gels with their kind of emerging oil policy, which I think is something that we should watch. It seems that the Saudis are very keen to avoid taking on much debt, so how they will continue to engage in this very ambitious spending program will depend on world oil prices. And I think the Saudis are increasingly taking the position of not wanting to necessarily bring prices down, but not drive them up too high, which I think is a shift from how they've been doing this in the past.
Good. I will come back to Mohsin later about the impact on the Middle East economies of the increase in spending that is very evident, which also I presume is going to have some impact on the oil markets as well, indirectly. But let me ask you, Chris, what about one of the issues in the whole region is not just oil producers, but the famous choke points, right? The possibility that there is a disruption in the transport, whether it's through the Suez Canal or the Straits of Hormuz, et cetera, et cetera. But both oil production and oil transport could be an issue. And my question to you is, if you look forward, what do you see much potential for armed conflict erupting in the region for whatever reason other than what we're seeing in Libya at the moment? Does any of this worry you in terms of a potential for war?
I mean, I think there are a few things that worry me. One is the future of Yemen and what's going on in Bahrain. And in Yemen, you have a situation where the country's awash in small arms, and everything that could be going wrong in the country is going wrong on top of this current political crisis. Because the Saudis got involved in the fighting in Sada in the civil war last year, this is now an international conflict, like it or not, and the Iranians, even though there's no evidence to suggest that the Iranians have been involved in Yemen in Sada until now, it seems very likely that they would, seen as the Saudis have exposed a vulnerability, that the Saudis, for all of the money and military cooperation they've had with the United States, have not been able to defeat this guerrilla movement. So is there room for the Iranians to get involved in that? Bringing this to the transport issue, over 3 million barrels a day go through Yemeni territorial waters where Islamist terrorists and pirates have targeted crude carriers and warships and others, other vessels. And the Bab al-Mandab is one of, six or seven strategic choke points. I think there's always a fear that, as capacity in Yemen decreases and the government's ability to exert control decreases, these become increasingly, more attractive targets, especially because Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the group resident in Yemen, has a history of targeting oil infrastructure and oil facilities, and the Limburg was hit in 2002. There have been a number of other plots against oil facilities, and there's a whole theological justification for targeting energy facilities and energy infrastructure. The other point I'd come to briefly is the situation in Bahrain. Now that you have Saudi forces and Emiratis and others in Bahrain protecting the regime, how this will move forward, I think is something that we have to be very, very concerned about, and especially from an American foreign policy and national security interest, with the Fifth Fleet being headquartered there and how Iran will respond to all of this. I think others on the panel can probably speak to the potential for the Strait of Hormuz to be closed. I think any kind of closure from a military or a strategic point of view would not last very long. I mean, I think the Iranians' abilities to cause trouble and to close the strait would last, I can't think more than a few days before the American Navy eliminated that problem. And that has to be at the top of anybody's list of things to be concerned about, military commanders in the region, to think about how you neutralize Iran's ability to close the strait.
Jamie, you are talking all the time to oil companies and to people in the region, et cetera. How worried are they about the potential for military conflict or supply disruptions in the region, or do they think it's pretty much really under control?
The concerns on the Strait of Hormuz are often raised. From our standpoint, and actually a lot of from our client's standpoint, it's kind of down there in terms of a potential. It's always a potential.
Down there meaning it's
down
a
there
low.
Meaning not something to be concerned about here
right.
And now. Greater concerns on Yemen, certainly, but the Strait of Hormuz, and the reason is because Iran, clearly depends on that throughway itself, both for its burgeoning petrochemicals production and also its own oil production. You have to recall that all of these countries are, whereas before, and you've seen it from President Obama's talk, it's already starting to occur. Everyone is shifting and moving their offices and the like towards the east. That is the home for their new growth, their new customers. And so that is where it is going. And so there is no desire by Iran, which is already having trouble with ensuring that it can bring in enough investment and the like, to, you know, do something like that that would resonate for literally decades as companies decided whether they wanted to do business with them in the future. So they don't. That is not a great sort. Each company that has particular infrastructure and operations within various countries have their own concerns. Certainly, we spoke with Total as Libya was starting, and they were initially, you know, evacuated everyone except for, you know, two people onshore and two people offshore. Eventually, they took the people onshore out, and now they don't have anybody there at all. The rigs are completely empty. They are out. There's a lot of concern about Yemen, but that is a very small oil, essentially smaller companies work there. It's only around 200,000 barrels a day, so it's not as big of a deal. There is a concern about oil transport getting interrupted, but we're in a fairly decent supply-demand scenario, so even if that were to occur, it would not be as great a deal as, you know, like the Libya situation has been.
Good. Well, let me ask you this. So what I'm getting so far is that, yeah, there's risk, but there's also a lot of interest to keep the oil flowing, right? Whether it's in Saudi Arabia or Iran, et cetera, they're going to work very, very hard to make sure that the oil is not disrupted.
Well, Libya is the same way. You see all these attacks. It has not been on oil infrastructure for the most part.
But yet in Libya, there's been a major disruption of oil supplies, as you have mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, I mean, people may not want to see the oil disrupted, but there are situations in which the oil gets disrupted because, you know, somehow higher forces prevail. You know, the desire for freedom or the desire for political change can overwhelm all other considerations. And so my question is this. The turmoil that we're seeing, I mean, is it just a 3-month thing, or are we going to be uncertain as to how things are going to develop over several years going ahead? Chris, what's your guess? I mean, are you going to have a really nice job at Carnegie just for 3 months or for 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Longer than 5 years.
Right. I think you know the idea that this will be over in 3 months is not realistic. I mean, I think we will be living with the effects of this. This not only will the current situation be going on much longer. Just in Yemen, it will be longer than 3 months. But I think the effects of what this has had on the region will be years, I think. And I think we are still only at the very, very beginning of all this. I think I would pick up on an earlier point, which is, yeah, I think it's not, when you say everyone is interested in continuing keep the oil flowing, I think, you know, Al-Qaeda is not interested in that. And I think we see that there is a history of attacks against oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia and in Yemen and lots of places. And, you know, as much as Saudi Arabia may have defeated its terrorism problem, in large part, it just moved to Yemen. And there have been a series of attacks and attempted attacks from Saudis based in Yemen against energy infrastructure inside Saudi Arabia. So I think this is something that we need to be very concerned about, because this is the best way to hit at the regime is by attacking energy infrastructure.
So essentially what we're talking about is we're talking about a medium-term problem here. We're talking about a multi-year problem. Where the uncertainty will persist over many years. That's what I'm getting from the panel, which of course is not terribly good news for the world economy.
Go ahead,
Hans.
I can give a little bit more of an economic perspective,
please.
Ultimately, the key problem in the Middle East is the inability of creating jobs. And that is either because of the Dutch disease in the oil exporters, or because in the other countries, because they can't absorb all the young people that are coming into the labor market, given the phase where they are in the demographic transition. So when you are asking when will there be real stability in the Middle East is only when you have solved that problem. And that is something that will take years. That is not something that you can follow in the news and suddenly you have the solution. But that's also why it's so important not only to focus now on the countries where there might be potential spillover, but to focus also on the countries like Tunisia and Egypt and see whether quickly you can get the institutions right and you can get a development pattern that is much more successful than the development pattern before. So there should be a lot more focus on these countries that have now a real opportunity to have a different kind of development than only on the strategic issues in the other countries.
I want to come back to that in a moment. Let me ask now, let me go to the second chapter, which is the oil markets themselves. And I'd like to ask maybe Jamie or Hans, if you want to comment on it as well, how you would characterize the demand and supply situation in the oil markets today, and let's say, what kind of scenario do you see for a year from now? I'm not going to go much beyond a year from now, because I've been a forecaster all my life, and I have made so many mistakes, even within a few months, never mind when you go out 2 years, and never mind when you're looking at a situation that is as unstable, politically unstable, as it is in the Middle East today. So I really want to focus 2011, 2012, and get your sense of, your best guess, of course, on oil prices, but then what kind of, upside scenario or downside scenario, depending on who's looking at it. You see, Jamie, Hans, if you'd like to.
Take this for the economic part? Oh, I can take it, but
First of all, there's a lot of volatility, but it is interesting that if you look over the month of March, that oil prices actually have been relatively stable. So they are now on average $110, which is basically the same as where they were at the beginning of the month. So that is either a signal that these prices are indeed driven by forward-looking behavior, by anticipation, and the market is very good in doing that. So once you have a sudden jump, then prices can remain stable. Or it is a reflection of the fact that once you have reached a higher level, there are feedback mechanisms kicking in that keep the prices from rising further. But I think it's an important observation that despite the fact that every time, every day we see something new happening in the Middle East, actually the oil market has been stable for months. And our best guess would be for the next year that kind of stability is quite plausible. At high levels, with some fluctuations, but around this is because indeed the anticipation was right and because you have feedback mechanism kicking in. On top of that, our assumption is that the risks are actually only upward.
Upwards meaning higher upward, oil
higher, higher oil prices. So there I agree that given the fact that the world economy, despite the oil market what's happening now, is actually at a new rebound now, where you can only expect continued high demand, especially in the developing world, there's no real reason why oil prices suddenly would drop sharply. While there are scenarios possible where oil prices would go much higher. So if I had to design now a kind of a forecast, I would add risk scenarios with higher oil prices.
Jamie? Mostly not come to you. Yeah, Jamie.
The only thing I would say is a couple of things. Is you're right, there has not been a whole lot of volatility on the oil price despite all of this stuff going on. And we would view that as an indication that the market is actually really well supplied, that there isn't, as much as paper traders would love to test higher levels, they're not able to move forward and move that up. And that is because there has been there's plenty of oil out there to handle the demand. The rise before all this happened that Mohsin was talking about earlier was primarily a thought that demand was going much stronger, that it had been a much stronger we were on a stronger demand path, that the recovery, the global recovery was moving in a much, stronger direction. And so that's why you were already starting to get that price rise. So right now there isn't a real ability to move up because there is still plenty enough oil. There isn't anything to support the actual physical barrels moving much higher. Certainly if you have another disruption, Algeria goes offline or the like, that could bring it up. But then you'll start to get into the feedback effects, which is essentially you'll start to see a demand response to this. The global economy right now is still recovering. And while we can handle, you know, $110, $120, it depends on the higher price, the ability to handle it both depends on the level of the price, but it also depends on how fast you get to that price. If it's a sudden overnight sort of shock, you will see a quick demand response, and then you'll see prices start to fall down. Now, you can only fall so low before you start to impact the really high marginal costs, such as the Canadian oil sands or the like. But that's the issue, is that you can't go too much higher really quickly for a durable period of time. It would be tough for the global economy to handle that, which then has, you know, huge implications in terms of us moving back towards a Great Recession sort of scenario.
Well, what is PFC Energy's flaw in the oil markets? You mentioned Canadian oil, Canadian shale oil. What do you think their production costs are these days?
They need around, you know, and it depends. It's always a project by project. But say, you know, around $75. And that is actually $75 to get their margin. And that actually is why, if you saw after the collapse, you saw Saudi's King Abdullah come out and say his fair oil price was $75. The $75 price was not that they needed $75, that it cost them $75. It was a recognition that all of these different supply sources were needed to come online, and $75 is what is needed to bring all of them online so that the world can have enough oil.
So basically, best possible scenario for the world economy is $75. No lower than $75.
I don't know if I would say that's the best for the economy. Yeah. Certainly it would be the best for my gasoline bill. But if we go down to $75, that to me, for us to move down there is an indication to me that we've had some sort of economic break, that things are not actually, while the oil price may be great, the economy itself is probably not doing well.
Okay. So under a normal economic growth scenario minimum, $75 is sort of the floor.
At this point, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, just on that point, I would also say for the Saudis now, given their spending plans that you talked about, et cetera, for them to stay, basically have enough revenues to cover that spending, they need between $80 and $90 a barrel. It's no longer a case that, you know, the Saudis would then prefer to have a fair oil price of 75. They always said they want a fair oil price of 75. They actually need a price of something like $80 a barrel. And I think the point that people are going to talk about the future, I mean, higher oil prices beyond, you know, 110, 115, et cetera, the market, yes, has been stable. But, I mean, there are sort of what the black swan, low probability events. I mean, I just would like you to go back to 2008. In December of 2007, oil prices were in their 90s. By June of 2008, oil prices were at $147 a barrel. At that point, all the fundamentals said demand and supply are in balance. Everything is okay. There's demand, the supply is adequate, the market is flush with oil. What's happening in this market? What caused a spike in oil prices when they shot up the way they did? So, I mean, it's happened before, and one of the arguments that I've been making in that is that you know, trading in paper barrels or speculation became very rampant at that point and really pushed up prices. Well, that could happen again, and so I don't rule out at all the possibility that oil prices could be significantly higher. Now, that would be very damaging for the world economy. As I was saying, the IMF feels that sustained oil prices of 120 plus would be detrimental for the world economy. True. I think that would happen, and that's exactly what happened in 2008. The world economy slumped, and oil prices went down to $35 a barrel. And so I think that kind of scenario is still out there in the cards, and I think it may be a low probability event, Yuri, but I sure wouldn't rule it out.
So essentially, we have a floor of around 75 in normal economic conditions. We have a baseline of somewhere near current levels for the next year. And Mohsin is saying, however, there is a risk out there that the prices could go a lot higher. So let me just paint a scenario where you have three factors at play. You have continued economic growth, yeah, continued recovery. You have another disruption. Okay, I don't know, Yemen or Bahrain get out of hand. The tensions escalate between Iran and Saudi Arabia, for example, and then third, you have another speculative push by the financial markets. What kind of price are we looking at in a plausible bad scenario? And I like plausible bad scenarios because, you know, I know you can say it can go up to $500 for a week. I know that. But a plausible bad scenario where the oil goes up and stays high for, say, 3 to 6 months, what kind of number would you throw out there, Jamie, for example, or Hans?
I would say, you know, if you've got economic growth, but you're assuming that essentially everything stays the same in the Middle East,
with some disruption.
All right. So these are both. So you have
Have continued economic recovery because the economic recovery takes time to get derailed by anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's there, and you have a disruption in the Middle East, plausible disruption that.
Algeria goes offline, so that's million or so barrels or so, which is that's the most plausible, I guess, which is still not likely. But so if you have that happen and you still have the global economy, I would say the first thing that would happen is that one off is you would have prices probably shoot up to say 140 or so. Then they would start to come back down as, depending on if I'm right or if others are right, that Saudi Arabia has plenty of spare capacity that they could make up those barrels. Those UAE and some other places, you could make up those barrels. And so the price would then come back down to probably slightly above levels that they are right now. And then we would again go back to this sort of level, volatile, but kind of sticking around that point as the economy kept moving up. Because essentially you would still have a risk premium on that, on those barrels, but there's still enough supply out there to meet the growing demand.
Good. Hans, any views, additions?
I like round numbers, so, and I don't like thinking through complete disasters. So I would suggest that it is interesting at the moment to think through a scenario where oil prices are $150 for some period, and see what the consequences are for the world economy.
Good, good. So 140, 150 is sort of a plausible bad scenario for the global economy. Let me ask you, before we move to the last chapter, which is the macroeconomic consequences, let me ask you this. We focus very much on the Middle East turmoil as affecting oil markets. Is, in fact, the Middle East the key driver here of these prices these days, the Middle East turmoil? Or are there other factors? Can other factors dominate what is happening in the Middle East? And here I ask you to think not just about the next year, but perhaps the next 3 or 4 years, because, you know, some of these factors are fundamental and are more easily discussed than, you know, what's going to happen in Yemen next year. How do you see kind of a little bit the medium term playing out in the oil markets, aside from the Middle East? What other factors are important? Jamie, maybe you again. Yeah.
Right. I guess over the next 3 to 5 years, you've got a couple of issues going on. If you've got a lot of focus in the oil markets and the economy as well, is looking at China and how China is going to develop. They've recognized that their oil demand path is perhaps a little bit too strong. So their 5-year plan, which they're not going to make, but it will, you know, move into the right direction, which is essentially it will move towards electric cars and trying to limit the growth of that oil going forward. The other issues looking forward is, you know, can Saudi Arabia, which is essentially the home of spare capacity, are they going to be able to continue to meet their needs? And their needs in terms of both the globe, in terms of what the globe needs, the world needs from them, from their oil, but also their own internal demand. Certainly, as Mohsin mentioned, their price that they need is going up, and it's going up quite a bit. And before, whereas it was, you know, looking relatively flat, it's going to continue to rise as they are increasing their own demand. They are actually becoming a major demand center themselves. Last year, they burnt, you know, at one point in the summer, over 1 million barrels a day in crude just for their own power generation. We think here in the United States in terms of coal and natural gas. There, it's, you know, crude oil is a primary way that they continue to fuel their own economy. This summer, you could see a point on a peak day of, you know, 1.4, 1.5 million barrels a day. That sort of growth comes out of how much oil they can actually put out onto the global markets. And you saw it just 2 days ago, where they brought in all the service companies, and they are starting on an extensive drilling campaign, likely in Manifa and some other places, to keep that spare capacity up. So there's a lot of concerns both on the demand side and how the still developing economies are going to grow, not just China but also the Middle East, and then on the supply side, the ability to be able to continue to meet that need.
Good, Mohsin.
One thing I should mention, I mean, is that people have been wondering about the growth of oil demand in China and India, and making various assumptions based on their growth rates, etc. But one thing to keep in mind is that both countries, both India and China, are rapidly trying to build up their own strategic oil reserves. Right now, China has a target of 300 million barrels in their. They only have 60 right now in their thing. So over the next 2-3 years, they want to bring it up to 300. India is looking into the same sort of thing. They don't want to be held hostage to developments in the oil markets. So that, irrespective, I think, of what growth rates you plug in for China and India, they're still going to be demanding oil in order to build up their strategic oil reserves, much like the U.S. And basically, they want to get there. So I don't see any slowdown myself. I don't see any slowdown in the demand for oil over the next 2-3 years. I do see supply not moving as fast to meet up with keep up with the demand. I think a lot of the problems are going to be in the creation of refineries that can then can process the heavier crudes that Saudi produces. That's going to be a problem. It's going to take a while. So I think that to me, it's all, as Hans was saying, it's all upside. I mean, that oil prices, the oil market would be dominated by increased demand, not such rapid increase in supply, so prices are going to be trending upwards, irrespective of what I said about the black swan events.
Hans, would you agree that the supply demand balance of oil is going to be pretty tight over the next 3 to 5 years? Is that your sense, or is there maybe there's a whole bunch of supply? They keep talking about Brazil, and United States apparently is now able to increase its production of oil because of new technologies. They have, you know, little mouse, that electronic mice that find the oil, something like that. Hans?
No, first, I would indeed agree that demand will continue to grow. The Chinese are very much looking in conserving energy. They want to make green growth as a central part of their strategy. They're even open for carbon taxes. They look at all kinds of alternatives. But I would agree that would only slow the growth of demand, but it would still continue to grow. I would say that at least for the traditional market, the role of the Middle East will remain important for the medium run, because if anything, the share of the Middle East in the known reserves is only increasing at the moment. But then the big question is, there are two big questions. One is, what is actually the cost of real backstop technologies, whether in fossil fuels or in others? And that might be lower than we think at the moment. And the second question is, what will happen with energy and climate policy across the world? Because those two ultimately will determine the long run. But in the short run, I would agree. Demand will grow and the Middle East will be important. So as far as there remain problems in the Middle East, we are looking at a tight situation.
Good. All right. That's very helpful. Let me go to the last chapter then of my questions, which is the economic consequences. And let me start with the Middle East itself. What economic consequences do you see, Mohsin, for the Middle East region from both the turmoil and the dynamics of the oil market? Because to some degree, they're working in opposite directions.
I think, it's a good question, Uriel, a question that a lot of people ask. I think it's, to be quite frank, I would say it's really too early to tell what's going to happen to the economies, the MENA economies in this new environment. What toll has this turmoil created, extracted out of the countries? And so what I think is to me a more interesting question. I mean, there will be some costs, undoubtedly. I mean, there'll be growth costs, there'll be inflationary costs, there'll be balance of payments costs, fiscal deficits will increase, etc. That's what's happening, and I fully expect that to happen. But that's, you know, in some sense, not too worrying because you can find ways, policy actions, we are very familiar with them, what to do in those circumstances. But what I think is more tricky and a more interesting question is what kind of economic model are these countries going to develop after this turmoil? And this goes back to what Hans was saying about jobs, lack of jobs, and so on. If the fundamental, I think that we're in for a real dose of populism in these countries. There is not, I mean, I cannot see in any of these countries a politician running for election in any of these countries on the platform of conservative monetary and fiscal policies that will raise interest rates, that will lower fiscal deficits. This is going to be fiscal stimulus, for sure, monetary easing, for sure. All these will happen. And what I think is what is the economic model? Then it becomes the populist model of an expansionary, the government undertaking expansionary policies. And how will it create jobs? Well, I suspect that I know you cannot create jobs instantaneously. It takes a long time, job training and so on and so forth. But the demand by the people in the streets, by the young people in the streets for jobs is going to be there. How do you satisfy that demand? Well, you look back and say, well, the best way to do that is through public employment schemes. Okay? So you're going to have sort of the New Deal, if you like, in the Middle East. And the New Deal will mean you will be creating jobs in the government, in public employment schemes, and so on. So you will find an expanded government sector, easier fiscal policies, easier monetary policies, food subsidies, definitely. Fuel subsidies, definitely. Now, when you say, well, what about inflation? I mean, what are you going to do about inflation? Well, we'll put controls on prices and we'll subsidize food. These are, you know, you may say, oh, well, this is not going to happen in country A or it's not going to happen in country B. I'm talking about the region as a whole. In the regimes that change and in the regimes that don't change, they're all going to do the same thing. If you like, a real backlash against the old Washington consensus or the new Washington consensus, whatever you wish to call it. I think the economic reforms that many of these countries have undertaken in the last few years, to me, are in jeopardy right now. And it'll take some very brave politicians in those countries to just hold on to what they've achieved and not go down the path of populist governments. But I see that as a real possibility.
Hans, do you want to comment on that? How come authoritarian regimes give us good economic policies and democracies give us bad economic policies? What's going on here?
You can argue that there were authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, and the economic policies were not that good. So you cannot generalize like that. No, I think what is very important For successful policies is a consistent long-term strategy in a country, including government support, but at the same time a lot of competition and the right incentives in the business sector. And when you have that combination, and some Asian countries have that combination, then you have a lot of success. And often you need democracy to have the kind of competition and dynamics in your society that you need. And sometimes you need very stable government rules to impose the longer term strategies that you have. So I don't think you can generalize, but there are these two elements that that you need.
And Jamie, the so what Marcin is saying is they're going to spend more pretty much across the board, et cetera, et cetera. This sounds to me like, on the one hand, and they're going to subsidize food and fuel. This sounds to me like, on the one hand, more need for government revenue, and on the other hand, you know, keeping oil
increased
cheap.
Demand, yeah.
That's gonna be bad for oil prices, right? I mean, it's going to mean higher oil prices.
It's certainly going to mean over both in the short term and the long term. A lot of these countries in these regions had recognized that their oil demand had been growing too fast, and they wanted to slow it down. They essentially wanted to, in some ways, they're jealous that Iran got off its subsidy reform program in late December. And a lot of them were starting to move towards that, not because they couldn't afford it so much, but because they wanted to make sure that they could maintain oil exports going long term. Now that this has happened, that is, as Mohsin said, it is completely off the table. And if anything, it will go in reverse. They will, you know, like Kuwait handing out, you know, essentially 13 months worth of free food. So it is a concern on that the demand is going to grow. But I did want to raise one point that we haven't raised yet on the supply side, and that is Iraq. Iraq is in many a year ago I was talking with clients about how Iraq was going to, you know, move back into OPEC. How was Saudi Arabia going to bring down its own production so that Iraq could step up? While those discussions have largely kind of gone away, you can't dismiss the fact that Iraq production is likely going to continue to rise over this next couple of years, unless, of course, they have their own issues. And any issues that you would see in terms of protests there, I will predict will happen in August.
Good. All right. Well, let me then now come to us, okay? I'm down to pretty very little gas in my car, and this afternoon I have to go and fill up my car. So let's come to us. The global recovery, will it be derailed by these higher oil prices? Hans, we've painted a scenario of $75 floor, very unlikely to hit anywhere near that floor. A baseline of $110, $115, I'm referring to Brent, I guess. And you yourself said, well, a bad scenario, maybe $140, $150. How does the world economy look under the baseline and the bad scenario?
So I think it's fair to say that any increase in oil prices is harmful for the global economy. And it hurts the global economy through three main channels. One channel is that it reduces effective demand, because basically the people who consume oil can't spend as much on the other products, and the oil producers are not spending the money that they receive. Now, if you look at that channel, then, and you run that through our models, then every 10% increase in oil prices from their current levels will mean some 0.3% less growth in the world economy. So if you're talking about a 50% increase in oil prices, you're talking about 1.5 percentage point less growth in the economy. So less demand, somewhat compensated by increased demand by oil suppliers and by lending by oil suppliers. That is one mechanism that is, at the moment, most hurtful for the high-income countries, because they are expected to grow only at 2.5%. So if you're growing at 2.5% and you would have a 50% increase in oil prices, then suddenly you are back to 1%. That's very different from the developing countries, although the impact is actually even somewhat larger there, but they are coming off from much higher levels. There's also much more a problem of ineffective demand in the high-income countries. The second channel is that if you have really significant increases in oil prices, then there is the potential that it starts an inflationary spiral, because wages will go up also. And as a result of that, you will see a tightening of monetary policy that is actually too much for the state of the economy. That is a problem at the moment, mostly in the developing world, where you already see inflationary pressures, where there is a tendency for wages to go up also, where they are in a tightening mode, and that tightening mode could become too strong with all kinds of consequences in the financial sector. The third channel is the most dangerous one. The third channel is that it actually hurts production capacity in the world, because suddenly companies are no longer profitable because of the high input cost, or because the high prices are caused by an actual cut in oil supply, and somehow, somewhere, something has to give. And then you see that companies go bankrupt. And that is what we have seen in earlier periods of really sharp spikes in oil prices, often caused by disruption on supply. And then you are talking about really a next recession, a double dip.
Okay, but none of what you've described tells me, if I go to $140 oil, which is the sort of plausible high-end $140, $150 oil, I still have growth in the global economy, right? I don't have a repeat of 2009. I don't see the world GDP declining as it happened in 2009. I'm still seeing quite a bit of growth and quite high growth in the emerging markets. Am I right?
If you look at the standard mechanism, you're right. But if the $140 is caused by an actual decrease in oil supply, then that third element kicks in, then it's more harmful. And if suddenly you have much more unstable monetary policy, then you can have secondary effects in financial markets. And that is, you can argue, we have seen before. Then you are in a different situation. But in the same way, as the world economy is still growing, when oil prices went up from $40 to $210 and now, you could imagine a scenario where even with $140, the world economy is still growing.
Yeah. Anything to add, Mohsin?
I think I agree with Hans. I mean, I think that at $140, $150 a barrel, there will be some points off the world growth rate. But I wouldn't say that was going to push the countries into a recession. But I'm very mindful of the fact that what happens if advanced economies that are growing at 2 to 2.5% get a full percentage point shaved off their growth rate and are down to 1.5%, I think, you know, while technically not a recession, this is going to be very uncomfortable for these economies. And I think that there is going to be a significant cost, and there'll be a significant cost in employment, of course. And so I think that the costs are real. They may not be as dramatic as they were with the financial crisis, but they will be fairly significant at that price, and particularly if that price holds for the course of this year. I mean, if it went up, you know, next week to $140 or $150 a barrel and it stayed there, the costs are pretty significant, Yuri.
And that's what I want to follow up on, because you're saying to me we shave off 1%, 1.5%. Let's do that for the European countries in the periphery, the countries that are shrinking and have huge debt levels and are facing historically extremely high interest rates to refinance their debts. Now I hit Italy, for example, which is a big oil importer, very dependent on imported oil, with another shock. Yeah? Do I take Italy or Spain beyond the tipping point? Question. United States has 9% unemployment. I hit the United States with 1.5%. Unemployment, which is declining, now starts going up again. The political scene in the United States is not very happy at the moment. Do I take the United States towards a tipping point? Hans, do you want to comment?
No, I think those are very, very important points. It is somewhat dangerous to just look at averages, as I just did, because below those averages, there are parts of the world economy that suddenly are facing much more difficult problems. We at the World Bank don't look that much at European countries, but we, for example, are very concerned about the poor people in the world. And perhaps not everybody knows that, but for poor people, the share of energy in their consumption pattern is much higher than for rich people. And also, what is very important, oil price increases are one of the key factors behind the food price increases that we have seen recently. So food prices would go up also. So it could push a lot of people into extreme poverty. So behind these average numbers, there are some groups, some countries that are really hurting. So I think it's fair to say that the conclusion is that high oil prices are really harmful. Yeah.
Good. By the way, commercial break. We're going to have an event on food prices next week, you know, with the oil prices sort of feeding into food prices in a big way. The let me ask my last question and then open it up. It seems like we're playing a game here for very high stakes, very, very high stakes. Not only because 1.5% of world growth is a lot of money, okay? We're talking real issues here. But also because it could take a number of situations, whether it's the poor or the peripheral countries in Europe or the unemployed in the United States, beyond creating some kind of tipping point. So it is a very high-stakes game. And if it's a very high-stakes game, then I think Christine Lagarde, who is France is the chair of the G20 this year, Christine Lagarde might call a meeting of finance ministers of the G20 and might say, hey, is there something we can do about this? By the way, the answer could be, there's actually nothing much we can do about it. Is there something that the G20 countries, you know, that represent 90% of world GDP, 80% of world GDP, can together do to reduce the risk of this oil price spike that could be extremely damaging? Mohsin, do you want to?
You know, I'm not. I take the see the point, but I mean, again, let's go back in history. In 2008, Gordon Brown and President Sarkozy said oil prices are too high, we must do something about it. And they talked it, and basically the idea was to talk these prices down. But if you're not a producer, you know, you're only a demander, and also indirect demand. I mean, you don't control the demand. There's very little you can do about it. Now, if the Saudis turn around and say, look, we think oil prices are too high and we should do something about it, that's something. So I'm not sure what really can be done. I think what the idea behind the Sarkozy-Brown discussions was, they believed at that time that this was primarily speculation that had driven prices high, and therefore something ought to be done in the financial markets and in the regulatory system in order to control this. By the time that things started to move with the CFTC here in the United States, etc., the world was already going to recession, prices were falling, then, you know, they lost interest in that. So I'm not sure what can G20 can do other than sort of, you know, wring their hands and say, basically, you know, Saudi Arabia's in the G20, so they, you know, point fingers at Saudi Arabia and say, you know, you've got to do something about oil price. But other than that, I really don't see very much obvious short-term things that they can do. Long-term, yes, get off, you know, using fossil fuels, get off maybe carbon taxes, all those things come in. But in the short run, Yuri, I don't think there's much that can be done.
So, but some stuff can be done in the long run.
In the long run, yes.
Yeah, they might raise the stakes on doing more stuff in the long run, whether it's climate policy or whatever.
That's
but
right.
In the short run, not much you can do.
No.
What about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve?
It's very interesting. I don't know what an emergency is because strategic oil, the SPRO can only be used in an emergency. An emergency, I assume, is going back to the oil embargo days. That constitutes an emergency when there's an but it's very interesting how little the SPRO has actually been used. I mean, the one interesting, if you go back again into the history, the best example is in the first Gulf War. In the first Gulf War, oil prices just before the start of hostilities, or just before the start of the United States going in, oil prices started, because Iraq had invaded Kuwait, oil prices started to rise, and they rose very sharply from a low level. I mean, they rose from, you know, something like $15, $16 a barrel to $25, $30. Sounds very low, but in those days
it was horrible
high.
Back
then. At that time it was really high. What happened was that the United States then announced that it would release petroleum from SPRO. Prices plummeted that thing. And in fact, they fell so quickly that the United States never actually had to release any. So, you know, I mean, it was just the threat that you could put this much oil into the market if you wanted to cause it. And I thought that perhaps at the time in 2008, when prices were skyrocketing, one of the things that I was arguing was, why doesn't the United States announce that it's going to release, if the problem is too little oil, which wasn't the problem, but if the problem is too little oil in the market, why doesn't it announce that it'll release from SPRO and wipe out the speculators? You know, it was a bet that these guys were taking, and they would have lost very badly because prices would have plummeted. So I think, yes, they could do that. But the problem, I think, is that having been burned a few times in the last two, three decades about with oil prices and oil shortages, most countries, Yuri, are, as I said earlier, are trying to build up their strategic petroleum reserves, right? And so I don't see that as a real feasible option.
Good. Jamie, anything?
I would add, you know, there is not a shortage of oil. Yes, it is more expensive. The strategic petroleum reserve and tapping that, there was a policy change in the Bush years, which I think is still in place, which is essentially if an oil company wants oil from the reserve, they can have it. They can buy it and they can get it. They don't take it because they can find it out on the market. I do agree that if there was a, you know, if President Obama stood up and said, you know, we're going to release some in order to try to bring these prices down, certainly that would have a market effect. I don't see him stepping into that role.
But the market effect would presumably be short-lived.
Yeah,
right?
And it would probably be short-lived.
Yeah.
Because I mean, the other part is, you know, the United States is not as big on oil markets as it once was. Yes, it is still the biggest producer, but in terms of its marginal effect, its marginal demand, it's, you know, it is not there. We're a declining oil consumer.
Good. Chris, I'm going to ask you in a second whether Christine Lagarde should call the foreign ministers and say maybe there's a political solution to this. But Hans, on the economic front, what can be done?
If anything. First, I think it's important to tell them what they should not do. And they should not reduce the tax on your gasoline in the G20. They should not, to protect the consumers, they should not subsidize energy use to protect their economy. Because if they, as G20 countries, would do that, then the problem for the non-G20 countries would only be bigger, because then they would have to take all the burden. So that is not a solution. And sometimes that is tempting, actually, for those finance ministers to protect their own economy. And secondly, I would not portray these climate change policies or alternative energy policies as long-term solutions. There are two dangers there. First of all, long-term means that it will never happen because you're only engaged now in the short-run problem, so you always postpone it. And secondly, if it is true that the oil markets are very forward-looking and they incorporate now the prices, then announcing bold and very plausible alternative energy plans can actually influence the price now. So I would ask them to spend some serious time on an alternative for their current policy.
Good. Chris, Is there a political solution? Maybe we can, is there something we can do to convince these countries not to be so unstable? But what, is there anything that that we can we help them? Can we provide them with aid? Can we, you know?
I mean, I think for all the reasons that, have been said about, you know, how this is, that's not an alternative, I think looking politically, the causes for what is driving this in the region, this populist unrest, I don't see that there's an easy answer to. And these things are going to have to get worked out. I think some of these are systemic challenges that need to be addressed, and there's not an American or a European or a G20 answer to these problems. And that's kind of a painful reality.
On that note, I'll open it up to you. Yes, the gentleman over here. Yeah. And Jessica after that.
Thank you. Daniel Morrow, Johns Hopkins University. The question is, which impact, if the Japanese nuke disaster will have on the oil market? Thank you.
Anybody want to take that? Yeah, Jamie?
Sure. All right. So the first term, the short-term implications were there were a number of cargoes that were pushed back, naphtha cargoes and the like, as their petrochemical facilities went offline. Short-term, obviously, their demand is going to crash. Long-term, this is going to turn Japan from what was previously a society, an oil demand region that was in structural decline into a short-term growth. So they will, you know, grow by 150,000, 200,000 barrels a day, whereas before they were looking at a decline of 130,000 barrels a day. But there are some concerns about that, and the concerns about that relate to their power and their ability to bring on power. If there is an inability of TEPCO and the broader and Tohoku up to the north to have enough power to keep these facilities going this summer, then that can have real implications in terms of the channels into the rest of the world, because that is still very plugged into the global economy in terms of, you know, just-in-time manufacturing and the like. So that's a concern going forward that we have on if they can get that power. And it doesn't even have to be a actual power shortfall. You've seen the Japanese people have been just amazing in terms of their willingness to reduce their power use, so much so that it is probably going to have an impact on their economy. I mean, people are not going to work because they don't want to use the power. If you're not at work, it's very difficult to get things done, and that can affect things. So that's something that we're really watching this summer. Longer term, the implications of Japan is that this whole discussion on carbon policy and nuclear's role in it is completely turned on its head. This is it's a whole new game in terms of how we're going to deal with carbon policy when a number of governments are going to be very shy at looking at the only real, at this point, only real technology of scale that can actually do something to offset oil demand.
Good. Jessica?
Just to add something on that last point, very few people know that it was 5 years before we knew what had happened at Three Mile Island. It was not until 1984, when the reactor was finally opened, that we discovered that more than half of the core had melted. So this is a long-term source of uncertainty in knowing what the lessons are for nuclear power, that it is almost impossible to shorten. So, you know, that just is another long-term uncertainty to focus in. I also wanted to just maybe make a caveat about the comments that there are no short-term things that can make major effects on oil, on energy demand. In fact, what we saw in 08, 09 is that there's an awful lot more elasticity than economists recognize, especially in U.S. transportation use, when miles traveled per vehicle went down for the first time in 50 years.
One thing I would add to that is, you know, the use of and the growth in gasoline demand, it actually started falling a couple of years before then. And while we did show a lot of elasticity in our demand, there was two major reasons for that. One, Detroit and the auto manufacturers essentially collapsed. And the construction sector completely collapsed. Those two sectors, we don't have anything anything that I'm willing to identify that that could potentially stand up and say, yeah, we're ready to go out of business. So you are right. We showed a great deal of elasticity on our demand, but there's always, you know, there is a cost to that in terms of, you know,
well, having a real but factor. I mean, there was a turn down in vehicle miles traveled that did not have anything to do with the collapse on Detroit's part. It had to do with changes in consumer behavior, in driver behavior.
Yep, no, you're right.
Across the country,
people started driving less, and
people started
and
doing telecommuting, all kinds of things. So anyway, there is a lot of elasticity in the system. That never gets expressed because there are never clear long-term signals.
I would agree that $147 a barrel will definitely bring out any elasticities that are available.
But the point I just wanted to ask the panel was to talk about Russia. Russia has an awful lot of capacity with both oil and gas that is certainly not being developed with maximum effectiveness. And of course, the geopolitical impacts, presumably of a sustained high price, are huge there.
Russia.
Well, just one small point on. I mean, I'm not on the oil industry so much, but on it's probably applies to oil as well. But on gas, I mean, if you think of the holders of the three largest gas reserves in the world, natural gas reserves in the world, are Russia, Iran, and Qatar. The largest producer of natural gas now, of LNG, is Qatar. And the reason for that is that Qatar is the only one of the three that allows foreign firms free entry into production and therefore bringing in technology. And Russia and Iran, of course, have been very reluctant to exploit, to utilize foreign companies, or allow foreign companies to come and exploit the natural gas. So I guess what I would say is that, you know, if Russia wants to maximize its natural gas production and sales, et cetera, it's going to have a change in policy in allowing foreign companies into Russia. And that is a very big question mark in my mind. Iran, sure, it will not. And I don't think Russia will, which has all benefited Qatar. It's become, you know, such a small country, but the largest producer of LNG in the world now.
Let me ask a related question here. Why is Iraq production expected to rise by so much? What, first of all, is it true? Is it likely to go up?
No, well, I mean, they claim that they're going to get, you know, 12 million barrels a day by 2017, which even if you talk to SOMO internally, they recognize that is not going to happen. There will be some fairly significant level of growth. What it's going to be, there's a number of different scenarios that we have and lots of other analysts have. You've seen an enormous amount of growth in this first tranche as you've brought in a number of Western and actually, you know, Chinese and Russian companies. But these initial gains are very easy. It's essentially connecting up flow lines. It's kind of getting the easy sorts of gains. Over the next year or so, the real concern is transport capacity, is being able to have enough pipeline capacity to get the oil out. And also, there is a not a recognition within Iraq as in terms of what their actual contract that they've signed. And I think when they start to realize just how much they have to pay these companies, there's probably going to be a rediscussion of that contract, which could happen.
5 years ago, when oil production in Iraq was 1.5 million barrels a day, today it was expected in 2011 to be reaching 5 million barrels a day. Today it's 1.6 million barrels a day. There's, you know, I mean, nothing has changed.
Well, but things have changed. They've had a number of bid rounds. They've got a lot of work that's going on there, and they have had some major gains in their production over the last several months. I hear you.
When they say in 2017 they're going to be outproducing Saudi Arabia,
no, no, no.
I take that with a large grain of salt.
I would say four.
Large barrel of salt.
Could I follow up on the gas question?
Yes, please.
And with another question. It is true that we should expect that gas as share of total energy supply will significantly increase, partly because there will be a lot of new findings, including in the United States, but also because it's a cleaner form of energy. So I don't know what your expectation is, but that share will significantly increase.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And here in the United States, I think there's going to be a discussion probably in the next couple of years. I've had a number of Asian clients start to look at the U.S. situation and say, we'd really like to export this natural gas out. And you'll start to see a political discussion here within the United States within industry and the like saying, we'd really like to keep this gas here to kind of build jobs and the like and not have it exported and go back. But you are right. I think longer term, you're going to see an increased use in natural gas, increased use of electricity for primary energy, both here and in China. But I think China will probably, you know, move a little bit faster than us just because they don't have the legacy infrastructure.
Any other questions? The gentleman at the back there.
Hossein Ebnusif, International Petroleum Enterprises. Allow me to make a few quick comments and then ask a question. On Qatar, it's true. Qatar has a considerable amount of capacity right now, and it's exporting 28% of the total, you know, world demand for LNG. But Qatar really didn't have much choice. They didn't have a local market. They didn't have a need. They didn't have a regional market. And the closest market they had initially was basically Europe, which meant that they had to get the right-of-ways from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Turkey, and others to get it. So they really didn't have much choice. It was a strategic decision that they made to go with the LNG, and it worked out fine because, you know, the prices shot up and they got lucky. And they do have a moratorium, and they cannot really expand quickly. On the SPR, you're absolutely correct. There are opportunities and there are limits, but the most important limit is that we cannot produce more than 4 million barrels per day from those reserves. So if something happened to Saudi Arabia or, you know, a couple of major producers, then even the SPR is not going to help. On the question on what is going to happen to Europe with the higher prices and the impact, I think Europe actually has a cushion because of the taxes on products, you know, much higher taxes. So it's actually a cushion. A 100% rise in crude prices is really not going to impact them as much. It's going to impact us much more in this country. So that's another point, but I agree 100% that, you know, the impact on food prices and on the poor in particular is really going to cause a lot of problem. Now, on the situation, the options that are available to us, the situation before the revolts, you know, started happening in the Arab world, the prices were high already. The options are disappearing, basically. The nuclear, because of the terrible accident in Japan, but also coal because of environmental issues and because of the safety issues in a number of countries are getting into trouble. The deep water, the hope for future expansion in frontier areas, in Arctic and so on, are disappearing because of the BP mess last year. Other solutions, solar and others, they're too small to really make a dent, especially now in the short and medium term. So we're back to the basically OPEC in the Middle East for conventional oil. And their main, first of all, OPEC has not raised production over the last 30 years. It's basically constant. Actually, the amount of the capacity that OPEC had has gone down over these years. What they are demanding is, okay, you're pushing for the security of supply, but we are demanding something else, and that's the security of demand. The question is, are we going to allow them to really discuss it, and are we going to satisfy their needs? Thank you.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Yes,
what was the question again? What's the question?
Because you're demanding that you know, the West has been always asking for security of supply.
Yeah,
they are demanding that you have to give us the assurance that the demand is going to be there. We're not going to create the excess capacity, you know, spend all the money to make it and then maintain it just because one day you may need that. So somehow they need that security of demand.
So can we, is there such thing as providing OPEC with security of demand? What does that mean? What are they looking for? Jamie?
This security of demand was actually a debate, a big debate within OPEC and primarily Saudi Arabia, but it's a couple of years old. And they have, in many ways, their thinking on it has started to move forward, and it's precisely because of the issues that you raised. They recognize that the globe isn't going to just build a bunch of solar plants and no longer need oil. They're not going to build, and this was before Japan, build a bunch of nuclear plants and not need oil. And so there was a kind of a shift within Saudi Aramco and within the ruling family, a recognition after being very concerned about this, that security of demand, while they want to make sure that they have it, it is not as much of a concern as they had in the past. And you can see this from their own investments internally for, you know, renewable facilities and the like. So certainly they want to make sure that they're going to have somebody actually use this not this capacity, but this production. But that is not as big of an issue as it was a couple of years ago, I think.
They have been. I mean, I just want to add one. I mean, for the Saudis, you have to remember that they have lived through cycles of high oil prices and very low oil prices. I mean, we've seen oil prices go down to in the 80s to 10, under $10 a barrel. And to in relation to a point you were making earlier, that Saudis don't want to go into debt. Saudi debt built up to 100% of GDP at that point in order for them to continue financing. So they don't want to live through that kind of. They want, when they say, you know, we want security of demand and the West wants security of supply, basically, to me, as an economist, everyone's talking about price. You know, they want some kind of a what they call fair, reasonable price for their oil on both sides. That's what, and that, governments can't decide that. Markets have to decide that.
We have time for one more question, if there is. No? Let me then just conclude that I think what we heard from the panel today is that we have been fortunate in a way, unfortunate, but also fortunate in a way, that we've had this sort of relative stability in this region. Actually, extraordinary political stability for a very long time in this region that is the source of a very, very large part of the energy supplies that are essential for the world economy to function. What the panel is saying is we are now going not just into a period of uncertainty, but a period of big uncertainty and protracted uncertainty. And that our instruments for actually influencing the outcomes, the political instruments, are very, very, very limited. And that the in the event of an oil price hike, the effects on the world economy will be serious, particularly in selected sectors and selected countries. That's what we heard. It's not a great story. I'm sorry about it. But I guess if there is one positive message out of it is, you know, if you're going to become highly dependent on this supply of energy coming from this region, and if you're not going to take the measures that are needed to become less dependent and become less polluting and become less harmful to climate, then unfortunately that is the consequence. That is the consequence you're going to suffer. That is, I'm sorry, it's a negative message, but that is the central point. So we're just going to have to sail through this situation, and we're going to be watching it very carefully. I would like to thank the panel. I think they've done a remarkable job of covering this difficult area on your behalf. Thank you.